On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, World Series stuff, baby. We review games 1 and 2 of the 2025 World Series. Yamamoto's gem, Addison Barger's big grand salami, and everything else that happened during the first two games of this set here in Toronto. Buckle up, friends. It'll be a good one. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that chanted, "We don't need him," alongside the Blue Jays fans to Shohei Ohtani. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And while Shohei Ohtani being the third host of the show would result in significantly more downloads and I would have a nicer car, I do think that the overall quality of the product would probably dwindle.
Yeah, I would say that Shohei is helping out this podcast plenty, not doing this.
We don't need him.
As like, yeah.
But we need him to do that.
We do need him. We just don't need him, as the Blue Jays are saying, on our team, right? We definitely need him to continue to be him. But I don't think that it is necessary for him to join us. Hello, my friend. It is good to see you as always. We are now back in our respective hotel rooms where we are about to recap the first two games of the 2025 World Series. We're going to work backwards. And our opener on this episode of Baseball Barbacast is another complete game from Yoshinobu Yamamoto.
I legitimately cannot believe I witnessed that, and also totally believed that I witnessed that, because Yoshinobu Yamamoto is singular. 9 innings, 4 hits, 1 run, no walks, 8 Ks. It is the first World Series complete game since Johnny Cueto did it in 2015, I believe. And it is the first time since Curt Schilling in 2001 that a pitcher threw back-to-back complete games in the postseason. In an era where starters are going shorter than ever, Yamamoto in October is bucking that trend. Now, the Dodger bullpen in his last complete game was more of a character. Tonight, less so. Tonight, he was simply so dominant, so overpowering, so comfortable that Dave Roberts, after the game, said there was zero conversation in the Dodger dugout about setting him out for the 9th inning.
Yeah, and obviously when the Dodgers, you know, tack on a couple more runs in the 8th, they get a couple homers in the 7th from Will Smith and Max Muncy that we can talk about, but man, once he has that 4-run cushion, there was not even an ounce of doubt. But even if he only had a 1-run lead, I would have had a very hard time imagining that this Blue Jays offense, which has been historically good this month, going into game 2, they had the second best OPS in postseason history for a team that had played at least 10 games in a single postseason. And I believe also second highest runs per game, 6.8 runs per game so far this month. And for Yamamoto to make this lineup look this overmatched was remarkable.
Yeah,
I think it is not an accident that the way that they looked was reflective of the fact that they had never seen him. But I also think that it was reflective of how he was pitching over the course of the evening, which was just better and better and better with every inning. I'm going to throw you this final stat here, which is super mind-blowing. Yamamoto retires the last 20 hitters that he faces. He allows a run in the 3rd when Vlad Jr. gets his 22nd hit of the postseason. Kirk drives in George Springer, who had reached on a hit-by-pitch to lead off the inning with a sac fly. But that Vlad single was the last base runner to reach.
Wow.
And this from the GOAT, Sarah Langs. Yamamoto is the 4th pitcher to retire the last 20 banners of a postseason game, and the most recent one was Don Larsen's perfect game in 1956. Oh. So while we have had complete games, you know, in the postseason and in the World Series over the last decades, and a no-hitter, yes, what we have not had is someone to essentially be flawless as the game goes on, right? To get better, to be even more untouchable as the game goes on. And after throwing 23 pitches in the first inning, even Yamamoto, I believe, admitted afterwards, he was like, yeah, I didn't think I was going to get there because of the pitch count. And only 105 pitches by the end of the night. It was absolutely masterful.
You know, you did something impressive when the only three people that have done it before, none of their first names, Don Larsen, Grover Cleveland Alexander, Dutch Leonard, exist in the majors anymore. There are no Dons, Grovers, or Dutches, right? So it's like, that's how you know it's been a minute and a half. Yamamoto, I mean, this is what they paid for. I like hyperbole. Jordan despises it. When Yamamoto was coming over, we tried to convey like the hype around this guy, why it was felt so thoroughly within the industry, right? And a lot of it had to do with the athleticism and the pitch mix and the command and the pitchability and the experience and, you know, the fastball angle. And the Dodgers gave a dude $325 million who had never pitched in the big leagues before. That concept, that action was both bold and in retrospect, obvious, because Yamamoto has paid that back and then some. I mean, this is historic. This is history, what we witnessed tonight. And I feel very lucky that I was able to see it.
I mean, what he did last year in the World Series, 6 1/3, one hit, which was a home run in the game, also in game two, victory. You know, that was 2 walks, only 4 strikeouts. But even that showing against, again, also an awesome Yankees lineup, felt significant. But this game is more of the continuation of an entire season where, okay, he's not going to win the Cy Young. Does he finish 3rd, 4th, 5th, whatever? But just like all the other pitchers, although we know Blake Snell got rocked, you know, in game one, we'll get to that. He's just getting better and better and better. And what he did to the Brewers felt more like a, like, man, this is the Brewers at their worst. But what this Blue Jays lineup has been doing all month, I mean, it's incredible, right? To make them look this overwhelmed, for the quality of the at-bats to be this poor. And they hit some balls hard, but they really didn't seem to have much of a chance.
No, they didn't. And the theme of game one was the Dodgers made Snell throw 29 pitches in the first inning, and so he tired quicker than he had earlier in the postseason, and so they were able to get to him and then get to the bullpen and pile on runs, right? And tonight, they make Yamamoto work deep in the first inning, and you're thinking, the Jays are on this, they've got it, they're going to do the same thing again. They might not score a whole lot of runs off Yamamoto, but if they can work that pitch count up, they can get him out of the ballgame. Guess what? The only way they got him out of the ballgame was to lose the ballgame, which is a poor strategy, in my personal opinion. Let's talk a little bit about the offense here, because you cannot win a game 0-0. The Dodgers score in the top of the first off of Kevin Gausman, 2-out double from Freddie Freeman, followed by a single up the middle from Will Smith, gave them an early lead. The Jays tie it up a couple innings later on that Alejandro Kirk sacrifice fly. And then Gausman settles in too. I mean, he was brilliant in his own right. It appeared that the Dodgers understandably were sitting on Gausman's splitter, which is his premier pitch. And he kind of moved away from it relatively on the evening, leaning leaning much more on the fastball than he usually does, particularly at the bottom of the zone, because when he's on, right, it's heater at the knees and then the split below the zone getting the chase. And he was just peppering the Dodgers at the knees, getting them behind in counts, and then they were getting themselves out. And so, like, heading into the seventh inning, you're like, who's going to blink first, Yamamoto or Gausman? And it was Gausman. He, with 1 out in the 7th, facing Dodgers catcher Will Smith moves to a full count on five consecutive fastballs. Throws Smith a sixth fastball that was supposed to be up and away. It leaks back over the middle inside of the plate. Smith pulls his hands in and clobbers it 404 feet down the left field line for a go-ahead home run. The typically banal and sleepy and cliche Smith turns to the dugout and hits them with a let's effing go, a rare sign of emotion that did seem to get the Dodgers offense to effing go, as a couple batters later, Max Muncy hit like the exact same pitch out opposite field for a home run. Now, Muncy is a lefty, but the pitch was to Gausman's arm side. Muncy went with the pitch, hit it out to left, 3-1. They tack on two more runs in the eighth inning off of Louis Varland and Jeff Hoffman, and the Dodgers win 5-1 to even up this series at one game apiece as it heads to LA for game three on Monday.
Yeah, I mean, Gausman was very good, of course, overshadowed. But again, the pitch count was a big part of his story, too, in a positive way. He only threw 65 pitches through his first six innings. I mean, we were zooming along there. But eventually, I think you missed to the wrong guys in this Dodgers lineup, and they will make you pay. He's very much missed against Smith. And in Muncy's case, I mean, that's just a dude with some serious juice, you know, pushing a ball over the left field fence. So also, we've mentioned this a couple times this postseason in terms of the Rogers Center press box, which is in yes. foul territory down the left field line. That gave us a very distinct view, or I guess non-view, of both home runs. The Smith one in particular was memorable because off the bat, it was very clearly going to be far enough. But whether it was fair or foul, we all just had to stare directly at the foul pole, which was right in front of us, and try and see whether it was on which side. Could you tell immediately? Because you could tell that it passed on the other side.
Yeah. The Muncy homer was different because of you didn't see the ball flight. And so for the Muncy home run, you're just going off the Dodger dugout reaction more than anything else. And from the family section, that's like, it's like a funny way to take that in. This is how the Dodgers win. Tonight was the perfect encapsulation of the institutional, you know, overwhelming strength that the Dodgers are. You have Yoshinobu Yamamoto, who I think, in my opinion, like more than any other player on this postseason roster, is the guy that the Dodgers just said, here's all the money, we want you now. Right? Like, yes, you could say that about Ohtani, sure. But like, they paid Yoshinobu Yamamoto, a guy who never played in the big leagues before, $325 million. That is a risk that 27 teams could not take. 25 teams could not take, right? Or would not take, rather. So there's that. And then you have Will Smith. And Will Smith driving in the first run of the game, driving in the second run of the game, which was himself on that homer. Smith looks a lot more spry and lively this October compared to where he was at this point last year. Go look at his numbers from the 2024 postseason. They are really bad. He had a 143 batting average and a 568 OPS. Looked tired, sluggish, worn down. And so this year, the Dodgers were a lot more cognizant about monitoring his workload, which they could afford to do because they could have rolled Jordan Schusterman out there, respectfully, like once every other week, and they probably still would have made the playoffs. That's probably disrespectful.
especially to you, not if I was catching. Terrible idea.
You get my point. And sure, so maybe. Them resting Will Smith various points throughout the year. Now, part of that is because, right, he has the hand injury in early September, and he doesn't play all of September, basically. And he misses the first round series against the Reds. And it's like, is Will Smith going to be back? In what capacity? He's on the roster against the Phillies and the DS. He doesn't start the first two games. They have Rortvedt back there, and they bring Smith in like the fifth inning, right? But since game three of the DS, he has caught every single inning of every single game for the Dodgers. And he looks like Will Smith is supposed to look, which was not the case a year ago. Very important.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, but he hadn't had an extra base hit yet before this home run tonight. And that was the question when we previewed the postseason, is it's like, okay, well, presumably he's more fresh, but is he healthy because of this hand injury? And I think by now, if he's catching all these games and having swings like this, I think we can say he's in a much better place than he was even a few weeks ago. And so, yeah, I mean, he's incredible. He is one of the best.
Yeah.
The career that he is having so far is outstanding. And it's a reason that the Dodgers also committed to him long term with, you know, $140 million extension, even if he isn't going to be catching for the duration of that. It's not hard to imagine him being an important part of this lineup for a long time, even if that's at third base or even first base, past Freddie. Like, he is just as advanced of a hitter as it gets. And this was his best career season at the plate, even in a limited sample size. So it is not surprising to see him come up with a big swing here.
I'm going to read directly from my story. I think this really captures Will Smith well. When asked whether his now healthy hand played a role in his show of power on Saturday, Smith was not definitive. Quote, "I hope so, sure, but that's me. I'm just trying not to do too much. Move the ball. Help this offense score runs," said the catcher with the fifth highest slugging percentage of the century. Not trying to do too much out there, Will Smith.
Nope. But nope. And he never will be. But whatever it is working. So this is a huge win for the Dodgers, of course. And Yamamoto remains the headline. And I could just marvel at him and talk about how special
let me
he
hop
is
in.
For a long time. But yeah.
Watching you watch Yamamoto was very fun. Like, you are just so genuinely smitten by his style of pitching. And, I don't know if I've ever watched you watch him like that. Can you, before we take a break, try and share with people what it is specifically about Yamamoto that you enjoy as an entertainment product, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think he's just a really perfect blend of unbelievable stuff, unbelievable precision. It is not a Skeens, Scooble, Crochet, I am just flatly going to overwhelm you with velocity, or just even you know, the way that Scooble's changeup works and the way that Skeens' everything works and Crochet and the slider, whatever. It is a dominance that is balanced, that is thoughtful, that is, he throws six different pitches. It's really mostly four tonight, the splitter, the four seamer, the curveball, and the cutter. And especially when you talk about that curveball and the range of velocity that you're seeing with the fastball up to 98 and the curveball as low as, I believe, 74 is as low as he went in this one. Again, you know, we've seen Japanese pitchers have this kind of style, Darvish at his peak, but man, Yamamoto still has kind of that FU potential also, you know, when he sets you up, and for him to kind of be going back and forth between setting you up to take you down with a curveball, setting you up to take you down with a fastball, like all of that is just beautiful. And when you combine it with just his incredible athleticism and a delivery that is very unique, It's the total package.
Well, he's a singular athlete. There really aren't any other pitchers like this. You know, there are aspects of Strider and Stroman in terms of, undersized guys with a lot of lower half balance. But the way that he falls forward, there's this like half beat in the delivery where you're like, how is he going to get his body in a position to throw this pitch 97 miles an hour at home plate, right? And then out of nowhere, his limbs just zip into position, and then the ball's by you.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, for him to be able to, you know, he gets a whiff on every pitch, basically, at least once in this one. And the splitter speaks for itself. We spent enough time talking about all the splitters, whether it's Gossman's or Yusavage, or we'll see Ohtani, and like, but it's the whole thing. It's all of it together in concert. Everything has a purpose. And when he's just getting better as the game goes on, I mean, like I said, it was just, even before the Dodgers tacked on those runs later, we were all just like, wow, like we're about to watch a complete game. which you basically...
We knew.
The fact, yeah, that, the fact like, that we could say that in the sixth inning is absurd. Not just in this era, but with this Blue Jays offense and all these things. So that's why I was very grateful to watch it. Yeah.
You make a great point, because in his first outing and like in the crochet start in the wild card round and in like one of the Scooble games, there was the whole drama of it was, is he going to come back out? Is this guy going to keep going? Yamamoto, what made tonight so special is that no one asked the question, right? He was so good that it didn't need to be asked. And that's its own level of utter dominance. All right, Jordan, let's take a break. And when we get back, we'll talk about the Blue Jays winning game one of the World Series, which did happen. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast as we continue to go backwards, both in our own emotional development and in this World Series. Let's do game one. A contest that the Toronto Blue Jays, in their first World Series game since 1993, won handedly by the score of 11-4. That is a blowout-ish final line, but this game was much closer for most of the early going.
Yeah, you know, we got Snell against the rookie, Trey Savage, making his fourth postseason start after making just three regular season starts. So that was, of course, already an absurd way for the evening to begin. We also had the dramatic and fascinating inclusion of Bo Bichette in the starting lineup. This was something we speculated about coming into the World Series, and we were pretty correct, I believe, in terms of what we thought was roughly going to happen, which is that Bo Bichette was going to come back and he was going to play second base. And that is exactly what happened. So he played second base, batted cleanup in game one. Didn't mention him much in game two because while he did pinch hit later, he did not start against Yamamoto. Not that I think that would have made much of a difference, but he did start in game one. He got a hit in his first at bat. He drew a walk. He made multiple nice plays at second base. It wasn't pretty, but he got the job done. And it was just really cool to see Bo Bichette back. The Let's Go Bo chants were, you know, some of the loudest of the night. That was a really, really, really cool moment. But the biggest swings of this game did not come from Bo Bichette. So the Dodgers take an early lead in the top of the second against the Savages. Savages just doesn't really have it. I will say it did feel pretty significant. You know, he gives up another run in the third, but he comes back out in the fourth and goes 1-2-3 in the bottom of the order. And that felt like really, really important at the time because it really felt like it was kind of slipping away there. And you knew he wasn't going to face the top of the order again. But for him to be able to just get through 7-8-9 and just kind of settle things down, they're still losing at that point. I thought that was really, really important and really, really impressive. Meanwhile, Blake Snell is also working hard. We go to the bottom of the fourth, and Kirk leads things off with a near homer, I would say.
Well, yeah. I just think that the bottom of the first is so important. Like they don't score in that inning, the Blue Jays, but they make Snell work. He throws 29 pitches. The bases are loaded with two outs. There are two walks. He throws 16 four-seam fastballs. Five of them are in the zone. And we learn pretty early that Snell, either one, is not going to have his good stuff, his best stuff. And even Blake Snell's, you know, B stuff is freaking amazing. Or he's going to have to get it back on the rails. And he does a little bit. He's better in the second and third. However, come the fourth inning, he gets knocked. Kirk drives one backside off the top of the wall down the right field line. Because he's literally the slowest dude in the league, it's a single. But that doesn't matter because on the first pitch to the next batter, Dalton Varsho sends one deep and gone to dead center field to light Rogers Center up. That was a moment I'll remember for a long time. The ball cascading back into play off of the batter's eye, the plays jumping, the lights going off, and you know, there's little Dalton Varsho who, you know, is the only person in the world to transition from catcher to center field. showcasing the huge power that took a massive step forward this year, albeit in limited time because he dealt with some injuries. But it was just a reminder of how deep this lineup is, especially with Boback, like Varsho in the six hole, Clement in the seven. This is why they have been like a historically good lineup this postseason. Scores at two, game moves along, and then everything goes sideways for the Dodgers in the sixth.
Yeah, and that Varsho swing was huge, just considering Snell's dominance against left-handers, considering Varsho's historic struggles against left-handers. What a culmination for that swing on the first pitch there. Plenty more details than that. You can read my story from game one. I focused a lot on Varsho. But yeah, we gotta obviously go to the sixth inning here, because this is where really, I mean, this is one of the craziest things in World Series history. I mean, I think we kind of just let it all wash over us, but it truly yeah. was. And it all begins with a Bo Bichette walk and a Bo Bichette getting pinch run for, because Bo Bichette can't run. Bo Bichette can only walk. And so, you know, IKF comes into pinch run. Again, this point, it's a tie game. And it's only the sixth inning. And Snell, while he doesn't look great, you're still wondering, like, all right, how long is he going to stay in this game? And they leave him in there to face Kirk. Kirk gets a single. And then he hits Varsho with a pitch. And now we got bases loaded, no outs. And here comes Emmett Sheehan, who had a really strong second half in the rotation and has really struggled since they moved him to the bullpen. And this is a tough spot for him to come into, which is, you know, bases loaded, nobody out. But it just doesn't go great for Emmett Sheehan.
It couldn't have gone much worse. He allows a single to Ernie Clement to put the Blue Jays ahead 3-2 on a ball. Is this the one that was like, or was that Ernie's at bat in the first inning where he just like golfed one that was nowhere near the strike zone? This one was a little bit more center cut. He knocks it up the middle to put them ahead. And then we get Nathan Lucas pinch hit, walk. We get Andrés Giménez single, and it's 5-2.
Yeah, that Lucas at bat pinch hit, 9-pitch walk, fell down 0-2, fouled off a bunch of pitches, works the walk. Giménez makes it 5-2. And at this point, there's still no outs, right? And George Springer is coming up with the bases loaded.
Right.
And so this feels like the moment where it's really going to get blown open, and George Springer grounds out and Ernie Clement's out at home.
Right.
And so it felt like there was like, okay, hold on, Dodgers, hold on. All right. Maybe they can get out of this and they're only 5th. And then instead the opposite happens.
Davis Schneider is due up in the 2-hole. Sheehan is still in the game. If they leave Sheehan in, they're going to bring in Addison Barger, a big left-handed power bat off the bench, to face Sheehan. And so Dave Roberts goes to his bullpen to bring in Anthony Bonda. Now, this was a risky move because with one out and Barger up, even if Barger strikes out, you have Vlad up with the platoon advantage against Bonda. I need to double check this, but I would be floored if Vlad has faced a lefty reliever in a high leverage situation at any point this postseason, right?
Yeah. I mean, like, fair point, but forget the platoon advantage. It's the Vlad Jr. advantage. It's just the like.
Of course.
You're going to have to deal with him one way or another.
But if you're bringing
yes,
in.
It's true.
There's a world like if the Dodgers had a righty that they could have, like, they could have gone to Trinan. But in that spot, but then you have Trinan against Barger. I would rather have whatever. The point is, Addison Barger on the fourth pitch, he sees for Anthony Bonda. He hits a grand slam over the fence and very far gone.
Best kind of grand slam.
That was sick. First ever.
So cool.
Pinch hit grand slam in World Series history. There you go.
It's like. It is cool when you see, I guess we've now had historic grand slams in consecutive World Series, right? After Freddie last year. So, yeah, I mean, this was really something.
Grand slam.
Barger only his second homer against the lefty all season. Pretty cool.
The grand slam in the World Series also just reads like something, like when you and I used to coach summer camp, like baseball summer camp, you'd be like, what do you want to be when you grow up? I want to hit a grand slam in the World Series. It's like, okay, buddy, like, sure, you do. And then, like, you know, some very small percentage of the population actually gets to do that, and that was Addison Barger. Go ahead.
And then despite Barger's effort to kill the rally by hitting a grand slam, the Jays were not
Vlad
done.
Says no. No.
As Vlad they were not. Gets another hit, IKF flies out, and then here comes Alejandro Kirk, who homers as well. Bonda throws an even worse pitch to the catcher, and he makes it 11-2 Blue Jays to make it a 9-run inning in the World freaking Series. My goodness. Next inning, Shohei Ohtani hits the first World Series home run of his career, and nobody cares.
Nobody cares.
What a freaking sequence. What a turn of events that would be, how this would go. It was a very impressive home run, because of course it was, but it did not matter, as that was the end of the scoring for the evening, as the Blue Jays do not have to use any of their top relievers, save for Sir Anthony Dominguez, who was pretty good. Now that is sort of balanced
mattering.
Out by, it's also sort of balanced out by using Varland and Hoffman in a loss and them not looking super awesome, but still, this was an incredible win for the Blue Jays, and why we are going LA 1-1, because this was the offense we've been watching. Now, not scoring 9 runs every inning, but it is just a relentless group of hitters that are a pain in the ass to deal with from both sides of the plate. And it all came together for an amazingly memorable evening in Toronto.
The Blue Jays lineup is good at a lot of things, right? They make a lot of contact, but they don't, you know, like the Milwaukee Brewers, sacrifice barrels or exit velocity for the sake of making that contact, right? They're not like Loisa Rising up there. They're still swinging hard. In fact, one of the main stories of this Blue Jay season is that their new hitting coach, David Popkins, came in and helped a lot of guys increase their bat speed. As a team, they're swinging harder. And I think nobody exemplifies that more than Barger, who is a man who lets it rip. He takes hacks. He does not get cheated one bit, as we saw with that swing. Full effort, no regrets, 4-run home run. Let's do a sleep on the couch chat. Can we just do this briefly?
Oh, yes. This is a good thing to end on for game one. Yeah, go ahead.
So, context. Addison Barger came up in the Jays system, right? Big third baseman, huge power, great arm. Can he play third? Can he hit for enough average? Here he is in the World Series. He was in extended spring training a long time ago as a minor leaguer with Davis Schneider, the mustachioed, very likable left fielder that Barger pinch hit for in this spot. Those two are incredibly close. They are like best friends. And so the night before game one, Addison Barger slept on Davis Schneider's couch. Now, did he need to do that? Probably not. I think that if Barger really needed a hotel room, the Blue Jays would have found him a bed. In fact, I bet the Blue Jays, upon learning that Barger slept on Schneider's couch, were like, what the hell, dude? Like, you're making the travel secretary look bad. But this was seemingly done in part out of friendship. Schneider's girlfriend is in town, so they took the main bed, and Barger slept on the pullout couch in the hotel room, which is even funnier because it's the hotel room that overlooks the field. just looking at your sleeping at work is what they were doing. Really? Yeah. You sleeping on a pullout couch at the office, and then had the swing of his life soon thereafter.
Yeah, it is funny to think the arrangements for the players at home is sometimes less luxurious than what I'm sure they will be put up in Los Angeles, which
correct.
I'm quite confident
because
will be a little bit more.
I was explaining
upscale.
This to someone today. The reason that this happens is most of the players, particularly those who are not deep in their career, usually pre-free agency, those guys don't buy houses. in the cities at which they play, unless they're like from there, right? They usually rent because who knows, right? David Schneider could get traded to the Reds in 3 months. And like now he's got this property in Toronto that he's, you know, it's just a hassle. So most of them rent and they rent 6 month leases because that is a relatively normal amount of time to rent. It is half the year and it is exactly the time from the beginning of April to the end of September, the regular season. So when those leases run out at the end of the regular season, oftentimes those rooms are already promised to like someone else in the world who, you know, is locked into the lease at these places. And so the players end up just like couch surfing or living in hotels for most of October. I remember in 2022, Bryson Stott was just living at Bryce Harper's house when the Phillies made their deep run. This is not abnormal for guys to like share living spaces. What is abnormal is for it to be a pullout couch at a hotel that overlooks the field before you hit the first pinch hit grand slam in World Series history. And the guy you pinch hit for is the person who you're rooming with. Like that's the first time that's happened, I believe, in World Series history. Check with Sarah Langs.
Yeah. No, that's true. That's true. Right. Maybe if it wasn't the first pinch hit grand slam in World Series history, you would at least be able to qualify it with the couch detail.
Sure.
But instead he just made all kinds of history and these two are very funny. This is a very, very,
they're very
funny duo. And it's also great that, you know, the detail of him pinch hitting for him, because they do kind of complement each other on the roster. At least as things currently stand. So yeah, it's a hell of a moment. And Barger is a ton from Barger post game too. I mean, the couch stuff was really all courtesy of Schneider. Barger didn't really talk as much about that, but Barger had a lot of very funny comments.
I talked to him about it after.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
He was like more hesitant to talk about it. But I was like, dude, you need to freaking sleep there again. And he did.
Well, he did. Didn't work out as well.
Didn't work
the second time, but will they room together in Los Angeles? I guess we will ask once we get there. But anyway, this was, as we mentioned, quite the win for the Blue Jays and more, you know, exemplary of what they've been doing, which is putting up a ton of runs and a ton of hits and making really good pitchers look really bad. So
that game was so important for just the whole World Series, because just the Blue Jays getting a win for the narrative setup just makes us all feel like I know the Dodgers are tied up immediately, but it makes us feel like we're investing in something that will be competitive, which was not the case in the NLCS with Milwaukee, right?
Oh,
and
sure.
So that
sure,
just right off the bat is just going to hook more people in, even as the series is 1-1 heading back to Los Angeles. All right, Jordan, let's take a break. And when we get back, we'll talk about game three. We'll spin it forward and then we'll do like 2 minutes on Tony Vitello. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Game three of this very captivating World Series will begin on Monday night and presumably end on Monday night. That was a weird way to phrase that. We will have Tyler Glasnow for the Los Angeles Dodgers against Max Scherzer for the Toronto Blue Jays. Not Shane Bieber. Shane Bieber will start game four against Shohei Ohtani. Game three, though, will be Scherzer against Glasnow. A fascinating matchup. Scherzer, remember, spent half a season with the Dodgers in 2021. It did not end well, as an injury prevented him from pitching in the NLCS against the Braves, a series the Dodgers lost. I don't want to say there's animosity there, but I don't think that like Scherzer cherishes his time as a Dodger compared to the rest of his career. And I don't think that like Scherzer was like solidified himself as like a Dodger legend in the 2 months that he spent with the team. I'm not trying to like make this more than it is, just more that like, this is not, man, he's back. Like, miss that guy.
Well, I mean, it was his, obviously his shortest tenure on any team. And there were a lot of strange dynamics of that run
Right, because he was a free agent at the end of the year.
And some, it was a deadline acquisition. So a lot of strange things that kind of went into to that tenure to begin with. But you know, he was in the postseason with them. But that team, of course, did not reach the World Series, which is kind of funny to think about, because had they reached the World Series and he pitched, this would be the fifth different team. Instead, it is just the fourth, as he pitched in the World Series with the Tigers in 2012. He pitched in the World Series with the Nationals in 2019. He pitched in the World Series with the Rangers in 2023. And now he will pitch with the Blue Jays in 2025 at age 41. And of course, I was lucky enough to watch what he did against the Mariners last round. And that was theater in every sense. And remember, going into that start, it had been so bad in September. It had been such a long layoff that there was very little reason for optimism with Scherzer, but doubt some of the greatest of all time at your own peril. And that is what happened to essentially all of us, as Max Scherzer was very good. He was really good. And he was a huge reason why they won that game. And now, with the proof of concept of Max Scherzer pitching well again, and with some rest, and with we know what it looks like again, it is no guarantee, but we can no longer just be like, this dude stinks.
So I agree
now,
with you.
Will I be stunned if he goes out there and struggles? No, because it has, of course, been a volatile season for him, and he's 41. But we will have a different mindset going into this game. Whether that is misleading or not, I think that that is the case.
I'm skeptical enough in Scherzer that I believe the key to the game for game three is not do the Blue Jays get the Dodgers starter out early. It is, can Max Scherzer survive? He does not need to dominate. He just needs to be competent. If he goes four and allows three, that's a win, right?
Maybe again, like, I don't know how much I'm trusting the Blue Jays to cover. I like Toronto's chances of scoring against Glasnow a lot more than I did against Yamamoto. And I would have said that before game two also. Glasnow's, of course, been good, but that's someone that they've seen before. In general, I agree with you. And that's what I'm writing tonight too, to kind of wrap up my story, is like, Scherzer is, I agree, he's the main character without a doubt in game
which
three.
Is fascinating, because I don't think we expected awesome. Him to exactly. command any level of spotlight. If like heading, we used to do this thing when we were in MLB.com, right, which is the board, the baseball October arbitrary ranking device, with the idea being that like every October is dominated by main characters, right? And I would say, like, if we were to do that right now, Yamamoto is one, like Ohtani is still two, right? Like, or Vlad is two. Scherzer would not have been in the top 100 entering October.
Yeah. And now, of course, he wasn't even on the roster. Wasn't even on the roster for the first
time.
Wasn't
even on the roster.
Right.
And now it's like, all I'm looking forward to seeing is what Max Scherzer looks like against the Dodgers in game three. It's just an unbelievable development that nobody saw coming, except for Max Scherzer. You know who else saw Max Scherzer coming, Jordan?
Who's that?
Tony Vitello. Tony Vitello, the former manager, the former head coach at the University of Tennessee, and the new manager of the San Francisco Giants, coached Max Scherzer when Scherzer was just a student athlete at the University of Missouri. Vitello was on that staff. Scherzer played there. The two remained very close enough that when I went down to get a coffee the morning of game one, who was in the lounge downstairs to see Max Scherzer and hang out? Tony Vitello, who was in Toronto. These guys are really close. That's not particularly important right now. What is important is that Vitello did the thing. He made the leap. I was skeptical it would happen. I should stop predicting where managers go. So I stopped looking stupid and having, you know, have to bike to Chicago and whatnot. But this is legitimately the most shocking managerial news since Tony La Russa was hired by the Chicago White Sox.
Yeah, and this is obviously shocking for 100 million other reasons. yes. But yeah, I mean, this is incredible. I wish we could do a whole podcast on this, and maybe we will at some point this offseason. Vitello will be introduced officially, I believe, on Thursday, the off day, or maybe the World Series is over. Who knows? His comments, first comments as a professional baseball employee, I cannot wait. He released a statement to some local media in Knoxville, which I encourage everyone to go read to get a early taste at the character and personality and mind that is about to enter our major league space.
People are not ready.
I don't even want to like spoil any of it. I just encourage people to go read it because it's that's Tony. And people are going to learn that very quickly. As I mentioned, the notion that this dude is going to talk into microphones, you know, upwards of 500 times a season now is pretty hard to believe. There are so many things about this that are so interesting. And I can't wait for this first glimpse in an official capacity, sitting up there on the podium with Buster Posey, man. I mean, this is just going to be something to behold. So again, like, the Giants are already a fascinating team this offseason. What kind of moves they make coming off yet another season magnetically tethered to 500.
I can promise you this.
We'll see you. Yeah.
The 2026 Giants will not be boring.
It's so true. I'm going to have to make a trip over there in spring training. I've not been compelled to do a spring stop in San Francisco the last few years, but that is certainly going to change. So I just can't wait. I just can't wait. Do I think it's a good or a bad idea? Who cares? This is going to be as cliche as it sounds.
Giants fans
podcast
care.
Microphones in sure. As cliche as it sounds, talking to podcast microphones in 2025, this will be tremendous content. The content here will be extremely compelling. That is, of course, not the goal of Buster Posey, but it will be a result whether he likes it or not. And for that, I am thankful. So
Buster Posey making a hire for the gram, for the doing it for the vine.
Hey man, we appreciate that. But let us know again. I've already kind of repeated myself, but I'm just so excited for this guy to be introduced as a character to Major League Baseball fans, because there's not, for all the time we spend following college baseball and talking about it and bringing it onto our podcast, we understand that it is still a part of the sport that kind of exists in its own little corner. And now that changes, because one of the most important college baseball figures of the last half decade now becomes a Major League Baseball manager. And it's going to be something.
All right. That's our show. Thank you to Ingrid Rosas and Andrew Hartz for staying up late and producing. Thank you to you, Jordan, for staying up late and podcasting. Thank you to me for the same. Thank you to all you for listening and making this possible. We will talk again when?
We will talk after Game 3 and after Game 5. So stay tuned on this feed. Don't forget, you can watch Baseball Barbercast on the Yahoo Sports Network, our first ever streaming TV channel, Yahoo Sports Network, available to stream on leading fast services, streaming live 24/7 on yahoosports.tv. Catch all of our shows on your phone or your browser. Most importantly, us here winding down here in the 2025 baseball season. It has been so much fun, and we know we have at least 3 more games. Thank you, Dodgers. Sorry, Blue Jays. You can't sweep this thing. It's not going to happen. Email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com, and we will talk to you next from Los Angeles, California.